I'm not sure. This is not your first time here, right? This you're like in the which class is this? Like the fifth unit or something?
Yeah,
like the first class of this unit, right?
Right, but this we went a little bit out of order, Venerable George.
Oh.
Yeah, it's me.
Right.
And so this is our sixth module. We started in January of this year.
Okay, so all of you, you all are sort of familiar with
it. Many of us, yes.
Yeah. So nice to be with you. I've studied some of this material for a while. I've been a monk since 1976. There may be someone here younger than that was born after 76. Maybe not. All of you look a little about that time. My name is George. You can call me Monk George or George. I say that because my Tibetan name, which we usually use, it would say my Tibetan name is Tupten Sultrim, but when people hear that, they say, I'll just call you George. As opposed to tongue twister or something. So, at the beginning, let's just spend a couple minutes to calm our minds. Maybe your minds are already calm. I need to calm my mind. So, let's do a breathing meditation. Have you done breathing meditation before? Watching the breathing? Okay, so you know how to do it. So, go for it. So remind yourself that we have a very precious situation right now. We're born as a human, having encountered spiritual teachings of Buddhism that are still alive and vibrant. We have essentially everything we need to practice that, the path of Buddhism. It's very, very rare amongst the many lifetimes that we've experienced and the many lifetimes that we may yet to experience in the future. I think that this evening I'm going to listen participate in the class this evening, not simply to amass knowledge, but to really change my heart, to really heal myself in a deep way, so that I'm less a problem for others, that I can actually benefit them more, and that I might eventually progress along the spiritual path up to even becoming enlightened. So it's kind of with that aim that we try to motivate. That's the reason we're listening, and in so doing you could create a certain inertia, a certain power. Even if your mind wanders during the class, or even if you fall asleep, having begun with that motivation that you're doing so to reach your highest potential for the welfare of others, that becomes a very meritorious action. And then relax. Bring your attention back to the present. If you feel lost in the distance there, the chair is up in the front, cushions. Feel free to get closer. Can you hear all right in the back? Yes, good. I think we're very fortunate to have these good AV people. They've made good. It's not always the case. Okay. So, this is Unit 6, Death and Rebirth. So why, you know, this might sound a bit macabre. Death, you know, what is Buddhism have some preoccupation with death? Actually, almost all spiritual traditions, real practitioners get their orientation by recognizing that we're not going to be in this body, this mortal coil, for a long time. It is the understanding of death is a motivating factor from the beginning, and it can help you to prepare for the time of death so that you can pass those last years, days, months, days, without fear. Whereas a lot of people in the West, it's a big problem. You, I'm sure you know, when people get old, not having prepared, in a sense, during their life for that time of death. Fear can arise, uncertainty, not knowing what to do, and so forth. So that's one of the aspects of death, why death is something that we'll be talking about. But another aspect of it, although it's not said here in the title, usually this subject comes up joining together the two words, impermanence and death. Have you studied about impermanence yet? Yeah. And also, if I ask you if there are, is there a gross and a subtle level of impermanence? What's the difference between maybe this gentleman? What's gross impermanence? Oh, yeah, no. Yeah.
I'll let him go.
Yeah. He's more eager.
If you don't mind. Well, gross impermanence it regards the things that are obvious changes of a phenomenon, such as a house breaking down or a car breaking down or something, and death. While subtle impermanence is the state of all phenomenon that it's constantly changing, even if it's not observable.
Not apparent, yeah. All phenomena are impermanent?
Yeah, right.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah. who agrees with that? Are all phenomena impermanent? All things impermanent?
Close enough.
Close enough. We used to say close enough for government work, right? Good enough for government work. Actually, there is something called the four seals. Not animals, but like something you seal something with, that are indications that something is a Buddhist doctrine. And they are all compounded phenomena are impermanent. So not all phenomena, but those that come about because of causes and effects. Come about because of causes. They may be the effects. All of those are impermanent. Then the second one is all contaminated phenomena are suffering. Have you heard that term before? Contaminated? Yeah, contaminated with ignorance and so forth. All phenomena are empty and selfless. And nirvana is bliss. Nirvana is peace. So sometimes people have said in the past, some people who hope to be Buddhist said all phenomena are impermanent, but there are a category of things that are permanent, like the realization that we develop, the highest object that we can meditate on to eliminate our delusions, our afflictions, is called emptiness. Have you heard of that, emptiness? Shunyata. Emptiness itself is permanent. Doesn't change moment by moment. Space. Now I don't mean the space between here. You might say, if I ask you, can you see space? You say, oh yeah, I see the sky, or I see the space between here. This is not what's meant by uncompounded space. Space, in the technical sense of Buddhism, refers to the lack of obstruction. So there is space here. I can understand it intellectually by experimenting. You know, my hand is not impeded, so there's some space here. But you don't actually see space. If you saw space, it would be something impermanent, because only things you see are forms and colors, shapes and colors. So impermanence refers to most of the things we experience. So that with that caveat that there are some things that are permanent, to realize, to have an insight into impermanence, to meditate on that, is one of the most powerful antidotes to our delusions. Until you can realize emptiness. My teacher, Lama Yeshe, who passed away maybe 35 years ago, 30, something like that, he used to say impermanence, realizing impermanence is like an atom bomb to blow up your delusions. And so there's a connection between impermanence and death. Why? When we talk about impermanence, the main emphasis is on, as you elucidated this young gentleman, what's your name, this fellow?
Zach.
As Zach had said, subtle impermanence and gross impermanence, the emphasis is on subtle impermanence that we'd like to be able to realize. But in order to realize subtle impermanence and understand it, and not just have a general understanding, to really penetrate it, you have to first understand gross impermanence. You might say, well, that's so simple. There's a lot of things that we seem to know, but we haven't really, if I could use in quotation marks, realized. Like, say, for instance, the inevitability of death, which is one of the things that's going to be talked about in this unit. Is there anyone here who doubts that you're going to die? Well, it might be some of you. There are was this terrible fellow who had all the sexual escapades, Epstein. He wanted to have his, I think his head and even some other parts of his body cryogenically preserved, as though he would, you know, later be able to be resuscitated and maybe live forever. Some people might think that. From a Buddhist perspective, we all have to die because we will all experience this gross impermanence. So it's for that reason there's a connection between impermanence and death. What we really would like to get to is to have an experience where the mind actually senses the momentariness of, let's say, of our relationships. When something is going bad, to recognize even at that point moment things can change. They are changing even at this moment. They can change in the future. To realize the impermanence of the self, our self-identity, the subtle impermanence, that we are not permanent, that is a very powerful antidote to the delusions. So to recognize that, we first have to understand and experience gross impermanence, and the most tasty, or say the most vital, the thing that is most intimate to us, phenomena of gross impermanence, is our life. So we say death. Death is an example of gross impermanence. Right? What is death? Anyone know? I want to make it, venture a... Who said?
Cessation of bodily function.
So at what point would that take place when the... Like in the medical things on TV, there's always, you know, oh, they try to resuscitate. There's a flat line on the screen. I'm not sure what that is, EKG or EGG or something. Is that then the person's dead? They say, time of death, 7:18. I'm joking. It's supposed to be 7:18 now.
Conventionally, yes.
So once at a meditation course at a monastery in Nepal, Kopan Monastery, that's the sort of the monastery where I first met Buddhism, there was another monk who took ordination with me eventually. He was not a monk at the time. He was a doctor from Australia. And Lama Yeshe was saying that even though the bodily, you know, functions seem to have stopped, the person may not yet be dead, because the subtle mind, not the gross mind that we have now that thinks, what is your name?
Joan.
Not the gross mind that identifies, I am Joan, I'm a woman, or whatever. But the subtlemost mind has not left the body. And this man got very angry, and he stood up in the class, and he said, it was a meditation course, 100 people, 200 people, and he said, You're saying that I'm a murderer because I've signed the death certificate for all of these many people, you know, on the operating table. I think Lama just smiled and nodded. Yes, Venerable Gyatso. Adrian. So death is not simply the ceasing of the pulse, or even the more subtle electrical signals of the brain. From a Buddhist perspective, death is the point when the subtlemost mind leaves this body and the connection, the karmic connection with this body is lost. One enters into another, in the path toward another rebirth. There's a state, maybe some of you have heard, the intermediate state, the bardo. This famous book became famous because it was one of the first translated into English back in the 30s about Tibetan Buddhism, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. That's how they translated into the title into English is actually the Bardo Todol, liberation through hearing in the Bardo. So the once you leave this body, you're, let's say, Joan is dead, George is dead, what was it? Zach is dead. Jason is dead. Sorry, Jason. Don't die yet, Jason. So there's a connection between impermanence and death. So generally when we say impermanence, there are the two varieties, subtle and gross, or let's say start with gross, gross and subtle. Death is an example, is an instance of which? Gross, right? If you were to realize subtle impermanence, you would, every instant of your life, you would realize that you're changing, and you may have, if you'd understood that, if you could understand that, you would have already understood the inevitability of your final gross death. And so you would be very concerned, you would be very careful with your life. You wouldn't waste time, because you would know you're definitely going to die and you're heading there because you've got some experience of subtle impermanence. This is some of the, just giving some background for the rationale for studying a subject. Right now, is it, if I were to say death is definite, it is certain that we're going to die. I think I asked before, there was no one who objected to that. But we may not have a constant awareness of that because we're not aware of subtle impermanence we haven't realized the fact that we will definitely die, that death is certain. I give examples sometimes. Say, for instance, if someone were to just get a text message on their phone or their beep, maybe everyone's phone would beep and say, a missile has been accidentally launched and is coming to this zip code in Raleigh, and it will arrive here in 3 minutes with an atom bomb, a nuclear bomb. At that point, although there would be panic and worry and so forth, but one would have an understanding, I can't get out of here. You know, there's no way to get out beyond 30 miles in 2 minutes. Maybe if you had the new Tesla, I don't know. I should have to think about that. 0 to 60 in 3 seconds or something. But other than that, definitely I'm going to die. So at that point, if I were to say, hey, Don Brown, you owe me $5. It would be absurd. You know, like in the face of certain death, the worries, the trivial worries of this life diminish, at least to a sane person, you know. So if you were to have an understanding through these teachings, through this unit, that death is definite, and you begin to see that every moment we're getting closer to that, which is like also a little taste of subtle impermanence. Say, for instance, the person who is going to be hung by the neck, executed in the old days, or being taken to the guillotine, or to the electric chair, or to the gas chamber, or the lethal injection. Every step they go, in their mind, oftentimes they're hesitant, I'm told, and sometimes it's portrayed in movies, but I'm told that that's true, that sometimes the guards have to, as though they know every step they take, they're getting that much closer to death. So if we could understand that every moment, as though we're falling through time, we don't know when death is going to take place. It's like it being in an elevator that's falling. You know for sure that you're going to hit the bottom, the brakes are off, but you don't know when. So at that point, I don't know if you would be playing games on your iPhone or whatever. You might be using your last minutes to pray or meditate or, you know, create a stable mind. but you know it's going to hit the bottom sooner or later. So you would use whatever time you have in the most, you know, useful way. So if we had a real taste of that, a realization of the fact that death is definite and that we're approaching it. You study in the earlier units what we call the perfect human rebirth, life of leisure and endowment. Is it a unit that we had? Or maybe not. Yeah?
Not yet.
You're the only one that says yeah. Is it called something else in basic Buddhism? Precious rebirth? Look, most of the people are...
We may have covered it some, but we haven't done a module on it. We've done mind and its potential, how to meditate, the path.
Got it.
Karma.
So one of the meditations that you'll be doing is to recognize this incredible situation that we have right now, life of freedom from gross suffering, like being born in the hell realms, or as an animal, or as a spirit, and how we have as I mentioned in the motivation at the beginning, we've met the spiritual teachings, we have the resources to practice. Very rare situation. It's called a life of leisure and endowment. And to recognize what we can do with this life, we can use this life to become rich and famous and have be president. No, thank you. Have pleasures of the senses and so forth. All of the things that unfortunately people associate with the American dream. we're not really as spiritual a nation as people would like to say. But from the other perspective, if you realize that as opposed to pursuing those worldly pursuits for pleasure, possessions, fame, praise, and so forth, instead of pursuing those which are trivial and transitory and not, you can't take them with you into the next existence, instead, if you were to pursue spiritual pursuits, developing good heart, patience, forgiveness, getting over your bad habits that harm others, and developing the qualities where you can guide others, you know, be a beacon of hope for them, that's a much better way of utilizing this life. So, with that as a foundation, understanding that we have this life of leisure and endowment, and it can be used either for worldly pursuits. What is that? Isn't it the name of some board game? What is that called? Oh, trivial pursuits. Trivial. It's the same thing. Worldly pursuits, trivial pursuits. They're all trivial. There's a verse that I find very moving that was quoted by a great lama called the Karmapa, the first Karmapa. He said, at the time of death, the vision of this life is like last night's dream. All meaningless actions, or say trivial actions, all meaningless actions are like ripples on a lake. So this came from his own experience. At the time of death, the vision of this life is like that last night's dream. So when you woke up this morning, did anyone remember their dream or sort of arise from it? Anyone here today? Yeah? Can you share, or is it personal what you've done?
I can share it.
Yeah, okay.
as far as what brings me to this point in my life, I had a dream that I was... Oh.
Yeah.
Last night I had a dream that I was back at the building I used to work in, and I don't know why I was there, but I was doing something, reading something or whatever, And I was there alone, which of course I would need to be because I would not want to go back there when any of the people I worked with were there. But then as I was leaving, I went out the front door, but for some reason I had parked like over on the right side, but I had to go around to the left.
Wow, you remember all this when you woke up?
It was very weird.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not always the case though, right?
Right.
But as soon as you woke up, and say the quotation from the Karmapa was, at the time of death, the vision of this life is like last night's dream. So when you the kind of sense is when you woke up, you might still have been thinking, I'm there, where's my car, whatever, you know.
Right.
But as soon as you woke up, what did you say to yourself? No, I'll put words in your mouth. Oh, it was just a dream.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't,
actually.
It was like, it looked so real, it felt so compelling, you know, that I was really caught up
right.
in it, but it was, we say, just a dream. It
yeah,
was a dream, but when we say just a dream, meaning it doesn't have the same importance. So, like, if you failed your exam in your dream, you might be really worried, and you wake up and, phew, it was just a dream, right? So, like that, it said that at the time of death, you might have a fleeting memory of many events of your life, but as you're leaving connection with this body, it's almost as though all of those fade into unimportance. You can't take them with you. You can't take any of your possessions with you. The Buddha said, when a king and a beggar die, they die in the same way. The king cannot take his wife and companions, ministers, wealth, scepter. The beggar can't take their begging bowl, their staff. They leave in the same way. You have to leave everything behind. So that might, does that sound depressing? Not so, sort of realistic, right? Realism. So when we talk about death and from the Buddhist perspective, we're beginning to approach it in many different avenues like this. I'm definitely going to die. I don't know when that will be coming. You know, the time of death is uncertain. And at the time of death, none of these things, possessions and friends and wealth and power, the body that we've cherished so much this lifetime, none of them can help us. The only thing that we continue with are the imprints left in our mind through practice. Probably most of us, many people, maybe not all of us, but many people will leave imprints of anger and, you know, grudge and so forth. But spiritual people, people that are on a spiritual path, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, Jewish, Buddhist, Sikh, all the people that have some sense of a spiritual path will... Did I leave something out? I thought you were... evangelical, Christian. Will leave some kind of imprint, we say karma, like a seed or a imprint in our mind for habit energy in the future. Little children, once they, you know, they're sitting up and, you know, not yet walking, maybe just playing. Some children, if they see another, if they see an animal or an insect hurt, they cry. They almost like an innate sense of mercy or kindness. You know, they like to pet the rabbit and so forth. Other kids, maybe with different imprints in their mind, for habit energy from past lives, you know, they'll hit the rabbit or they'll take a hammer and smash the ants or something like that. Have you ever experienced anything like that? Variety. So there's an expression in Buddhism. If you want to know what you did in the past, look at your present life. If you want to know what you'll be in the future, look at your present mind. So, if you want to know what you did in the past, look at your present life. Are you poor? Everything goes wrong. People abuse you all the time. That's a sign that you had done that in the past. This is the, as it, we talk about karma. You've heard the word karma? What does karma mean?
Action.
Yeah, good. Action. Karma means action. When I asked, I've mentioned this in a couple of the other classes, when I would ask people that visited the monastery sometime when I'd lead groups, college kids or high school kids or even grade school kids, many of them would say, karma means what goes around comes around. Have you heard that expression? Yeah. I'm not sure. I think a better aphorism to explain what karma means is, in the Buddhist perspective, is what Christ said, ye reap what ye sow. It's like cause and effect. You leave imprints in your mind from actions in the past that are bad, they're selfish and born from attachment or anger or ignorance or jealousy or pride. They'll leave imprints in your mind. Later, the repercussions will come, action and reaction. There'll be a reaction in the future when those karmic seeds ripen. So if you want to know what you did in the past, look at your present life. I would say that everyone in this room had not tremendously harmed others, and because you all look like you have sound bodies. You know, you have reasonably good health. Maybe some of you say, oh, but let me tell you about my liver. one of my friends, my childhood friends, I went to kindergarten. He went grade school, high school with him. He went off to Yale. I went to another school. We've known each other all our lives. We were talking on the phone about our sicknesses this year, and he says, yeah, we're getting old, George. Yeah, they say when old men talk, it's like an organ recital. Oh, my liver, my kidney, you know, my kidney stones or whatever. So you can deduce certain things about what you did in the past by your present experiences. Your love of knowledge, for instance, or your disdain for that. And a remnant of the habits you created in the past. So if you feel, I wish I had more interest in study or more interest in practice, you have to, if you don't have that instinct now, you have to create it with effort now. You have to create the actions for that, because we will definitely die, and the only thing that we carry with us at the time of death is the imprints of our Dharma practice. The only thing that helps at the time of death is the Dharma. You've heard that word also, right? Dharma? Or no? Do you know what Dharma means? Okay. You?
Learning.
Pardon?
I said I'm learning.
You're learning. I thought this lady next to you was going to say...
Oh, is it the law, the teachings?
That sometimes translate that. It's an Indian word, right? That comes from... Even before the time of Buddha, it's part of the Indian culture. It comes from a root word that means to hold up. So Dharma has different meanings. Sometimes a person's responsibility that they have to uphold in the Hindu tradition, let's say, oh, that's my Dharma. I have to take care of my parents. Then I have to... You know, raise a family, I have to have a job, this is your Dharma, you have to be responsible. When we talk about the holy Dharma, when we talk about spiritual things, the holy Dharma is what holds you up from suffering. Dharma. So there could be teachings that you hear, but that doesn't actually hold you up because you can forget them, you don't practice them. Actual Dharma is... when you develop some insight through the spiritual teachings, whether they be Christian or Buddhist or whatever, that protects you, that in time of need, you can call on those teachings, your insight into that, to protect your mind from being uncomfortable, from being sorrowful, from being afraid. Just the understanding of impermanence and death. I told this story, I think, in one of the other seminars here, but certainly when I was teaching in Washington, D.C. just before this, so it might have been there. When I lived in Beirut before I met Buddhism, I was teaching at an American school there, high school. And a friend of mine and I, he was a college student, an American boy. He and I put our money together and rented a house up in the mountains in Beirut, overlooking the sea and the airport, just to get up on weekends, you know. And at a certain point, he had a friend visit from the States named Fireball. Did I tell this story? Did you hear this? I remember that Fireball was either from North Carolina or South Carolina, and I asked some people, and they said, oh, with a name like Fireball, he's from South Carolina. So Fireball, he and my friend Steve, they, unbeknownst to me, really, they experimented. They bought some hashish. Do you know what hashish is? In Lebanon, it was very common. They rolled it out with a rolling pin, put it between two pieces of aluminum foil, and sent them in Christmas cards to their friends in the States to see if it would go through. This was like 1972. Maybe they didn't have the kind of security we had. So they all went through. All the people said, oh, thanks for that nice Christmas card. So then they went a step further. They hired the person who works with wood? Carpenter. A Lebanese carpenter to make pigeon cages for them. One layer, very thin layer of wood, one layer of hashish. One layer of wood, one layer of hashish. Ended with... Do you know what that... Did you have a question? Oh, no, I thought you didn't understand some word I said. So their idea was that the pigeons in the cages, the smell of the pigeons would prevent any kind of security people from... Right? So anyway, the Lebanese carpenter turned them into the police. And I get a call late at night when Steve is in the jail. I said, what for? Is that? So I went down to the jail the next day. He was a good-looking boy. He already had obviously spent a day or two in the Lebanese prison. We were like 25, 26, 27. I came and saw him the next day. He would come out into the courtyard. There were these big bars. One person would come at a time. You could go up and see him behind the bars. I said, Steve, how's it going? And I could see his face was bruised. I think he'd been sexually molested already. It was just, you know, sometimes in these situations. And he and I had read of some things of the Sufis. And there's an aphorism in some of these stories that I think you find in many religions. This expression you may have heard in many spiritual things. What he said to me, this too will pass. Have you heard something like that? Either that exact same phrase or something similar. That's an understanding of impermanence. Can cool your mind, you know. So like when the mind is so tense, it's like, this is going to go on forever. Just this will pass. This too will pass. And that had given him the courage to keep, you know, to keep calm and to, you know, keep his wits about him. So that's an example of a Dharma understanding. He'd been taught the words. Remember you were saying, is it like the text or the word, the teachings or something? But he'd internalized that, thought about that. That's what we do in meditation, when we meditate on impermanence and death, these subjects. So as not to go too far off the beaten track here, let me take a couple minutes to see if you have any questions. see if you're following what I'm saying, if it makes sense to you, if something's unclear, if you'd like some more clarification, or something I said was just wrong. You want to correct me? So, anyone? Come on, don't be shy. Oh, this gentleman who ceded to Zach before.
Yeah, I'm actually on top.
Okay, what's your name?
I'm Scott.
Scott.
Can you talk a little bit more about the subtle impermanence and that it's happening all within a second of time? The
right.
Change.
Even shorter. Even in the shortest moment. Say, for instance, a big boulder on the, you know, on the earth or on the beach, you know, looks so like immortal, you know, so strong, it's like it's going to be there when the hotel disintegrates, it's built next to it, and people, you know, you think my grandchildren will see the same boulder and so forth. But every instant, it's changing. It's getting closer to its gross demise. We know from modern physics it's not a surprise because it's comprised of molecules that are vibrating, different bonds are breaking and changing, cosmic rays are coming into it and so forth. Things are changing in the smallest moment. From the fact, anything that has been brought about by causes and conditions is changing in those smallest moments. In the kind of Buddhism that is presently still to this day practiced in Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, what we call Theravada Buddhism. Sometimes people say original Buddhism, but it's because that was historically, that's what seemed to be the main teachings the Buddha gave at that time. In that tradition, they don't talk so much about meditating on emptiness, or shunyata, the emptiness of the self. They talk about selflessness, but realizing the self is impermanent, changing momentarily, every instant. A very powerful understanding. If you go to a meditation course at a monastery in Burma, one of my monk friends went to a meditation course in Burma once, and the main thing was a whole course, maybe a month or 2 months, meditating on subtle impermanence of the self. If you could realize, have a deep experience, a taste, like see directly that the self is changing in the shortest instant, that can counteract the ignorance in our mind that just assumes, I'm here. I'm Scott. I'm here. Don't worry about it. Once you can erode that particular kind of ignorance that's grasping to the self as permanent, a lot of our bad habits fall away. So, from that point of view, one can understand what my teacher, Lama Yeshe, had said, that the understanding, the realization of impermanence, subtle impermanence, it's like an atom bomb. It can blow up our delusions. Like the example I gave before, if we knew the atom bomb was coming, all of our worries about, you know, my car payments or whatever, you know, I didn't fulfill my mother's wish, I didn't become a doctor or, you know, whatever, all of those would go away. You know, in the perspective of imminent death. So if you, with an understanding of subtle impermanence, you understand I'm on the way. It's like I'm sprinting. I'm in that elevator falling to death. It's definitely going to come. And the only thing that will help me when that elevator hits the bottom is my practice of Dharma, the imprints that I've left in my mind. Good habits. even I'm always impressed that so many kind people in the world, doctors and teachers and mailmen and women, and so many people helping in so many ways with good heart. But we ourselves can enhance our good heart. We can develop more affection for others, like see others as our family, as opposed to someone to take advantage of, you know, another sucker I can, you know, take advantage of, or someone if I treat them nicely, they might give something. I might get something from it, some kind of contractual friendship, you know. I scratch your back, you scratch mine. But real love is when you help others without any expectation for yourself, just to bring about something that will be beneficial for them, some happiness or benefit. We can develop compassion. Oh, do you know the difference between love and compassion? Who said, I wasn't sure that was it. That was it? So what was it? Was it
Well, I'll take a stab at it.
Okay.
I'll start. Well, love.
So is uh-huh.
Love is just wanting someone to be happy, and the compassion part is feeling the suffering so bad that leads you to practice that love, something like that.
That's not bad. Okay. So from a Buddhist perspective, in our English language, they may seem almost the same, or I'm not sure. But what's your name?
Jeff.
What Jeff said, more or less right. I'll just put a little fine point on it. So love, from a Buddhist perspective, is when you perceive others, and we don't talk about love for coffee or something like that. You know, I love peanut butter, or I love chocolate. This is supposed to be coffee. Decaf. I love decaf. But that's not Buddhist love. Right? Love is for others, wishing them to have happiness. What you're observing, the object that you're thinking about are other living beings. It can be insects, it can be dogs and cats, it can be harmful spirits, it can be your enemy, it can be any living being. Compassion is a counterpart of that. Compassion is when you perceive others and want them to be free of suffering. Compassion. You feel along with others. Compassion. Listen, does anyone know German? You're German? What is it in Mitgefühl? Mitgefühl. To feel along with others, right? So say, like in compassion, to feel passion with others. It doesn't mean you go crazy with other people's sufferings, but you have it starts with an empathy. You know what empathy means? To sort of sense some equality with them, and I can feel I can understand what you're feeling, brother, sister. And then when that is warmed, intensified, when you wish them to be free of that suffering, the same way you recognize, just as I would like to be free of suffering, it would be wonderful if they were free from suffering. Sometimes we don't feel that. We may see other people suffering and we think, that's their, you know, they deserve it. You know? That's I think, quite prevalent in our modern life today. So the two, love and compassion, if one is present, the other is present too, but may not be manifest at the same time. Like if you see a little baby crying, it's lost in the fairground, his mom's somewhere else, and where's mommy? You'd be oscillating between a moment of love, wanting them to be happy. Here, take this, don't worry. And then wanting them to be free of suffering, you know? Those are the, you know, love, compassion, wisdom, patience, forgiveness. All of these are qualities, spiritual qualities that we could develop once we've understood the inevitability of death. Okay, so I'm getting, I'm just repeating myself. So anyone else have a question? Yeah. Yeah, she needs. Oh.
Talking about the atom bomb of understanding.
Atomic energy question. Okay.
What?
No, no, just joking.
Okay. The first Karmapa statement that you gave hit me very deeply. And I got the first part of it at the time of death, the vision of this life is like last night's dream. That hit me very deeply.
Right.
And I missed the second part.
The second part, the second line is all meaningless actions are like ripples on a lake. So if you were toss a little, say a still pond or lake, you toss a stone in, are you skipping stones, you know. You toss a stone in and you see some ripples coming out from that. And as they get further and further away from the point where the stone went in, what happens? They get bigger? No, they get smaller. They dissipate. They become, by the time they get to the shore, maybe there's a little bit and they, some come reflects back, but after some time, gone. So, interesting expression, meaningless actions. You say, what are meaningless actions? I don't perform any meaningless actions. All my actions have meaning. From a spiritual point of view, actions that are done with the aim of just the happiness of this lifetime alone, just thinking of the happiness of this lifetime, are like those ripples on a lake. They're called meaningless actions because they don't, those actions that are done just for the happiness of this lifetime don't create imprints, karmic seeds, you might say, actions that leave, that will have positive impacts in the future. It's as almost as though they're like ripples on a lake. At the time of death, nothing continues that will be benefit you in the future. You might say, well, I've given to the Red Cross, you know, because I got my name on the list that was published in the newspaper, and there are people that give money, benefit at the university to build a big new branch that has their name on, you know, the Chernoff School of this or that.
So it would be...
That would be a meaningless action because although it might benefit people right at the present, your motivation was just for your fame this lifetime. It wasn't really for the benefit, totally for the benefit. It might be some thought of benefiting others. Maybe you make a cancer research institute, so you really want to have cancer cured, but you need to have your name on the wing, right, or the lab. Susie's Cancer Ward. So it's a little bit like mixed karma. When there'll be some ripples in the future that are beneficial, but some that are not so beneficial because you did it with a kind of egotistic, self-centered idea for the happiness of this lifetime.
Negative impacts in the future can happen. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, this lady in the back. I'm glad. So two ladies that asked questions both have green shirts and black pants. Interesting. What does that mean?
Nothing.
No, nothing. Right. Absolutely nothing.
I have been thinking about a question for a long time about the... I know that I'm going to die one day, but I don't think it's going to happen today or tomorrow. So my sense of urgency about it is not where it should be.
Right.
And I wondered why that is and what I can do about it.
What you can do about it is come to the next couple of classes because you're absolutely right. There is a meditation that we'll be doing, I assume. Correct me if I'm wrong. Where's the girl, Jill? Is that right? We do the 9-round meditation?
I'm not sure. It's up to the instructor.
Okay.
You could do it.
So there are three main meditations on death. As was preserved from the followers of the Kadampa Geshes. This is called Kadampa Center, right? The Kadampas were Tibetan great spiritual beings who followed the being who's represented by this statue with the red hat, Atisha. So they had developed a kind of meditation on death they called the nine meditations, nine rounds meditation on death, nine divisions meditation. Three main divisions. Each of them has three. Three times three is nine. So three main divisions are death is definite, certain, right? That part you get. But we still really don't have the realization of it, so that has to be enhanced. Second one is the time of death is uncertain, which is what you're addressing. If you meditate on that and you have a deeper understanding now of death, that death, we don't know now, we don't have clairvoyance, we don't know when death is going to take place. If you have that understanding, you don't procrastinate, because you could die tonight. You could die going home. I don't want to say it, you could die here. Yeah. I gave a talk in Delhi one time, in India. There's actually a Lions Club in New Delhi. You know the Lions?
Yeah.
Lions
Club.
Pardon?
Rich people.
Rich people, yeah. So they told me a story about I was talking about death, time of death is indefinite. And they told me about a story of some person who had spoken to them at one time at one of these chicken banquets, you know, like they always joke, you afterwards is rubber chicken that you eat. I mean, real, it's chicken dinner, but it's like, it's always like not so good. So the person had spoken about how to use your life, you know, to do your dream, you know, bucket list or something like this, because these are old guys in the Lions Club. I think they were all men. And the person sat down and the other person is leading applause or something, and the person is eating the chicken and a bone gets stuck in his throat and he dies right there, right after the lecture, right there in the room, they said. So we don't know. Time of death is uncertain. If you realize that, if you have a taste of that, that sense of lack of urgency is gone, because I may die today. In fact, there's an expression like this. The person who thinks, I may die today, not just I may die, I'm going to die today. So if you thought you were going to die today, you wouldn't worry about so many little things. You would try to get your life in order, get good heart, apologize to people, try to die in a happy mind. So the person who thinks every day, I'm going to die today, is wrong every day until the day they die. And that day, they're right. Right? Whereas the person who thinks, I'm not going to die today, is right every day until the day they die, in which case they're wrong. But the person who thought every day, I'm going to die today, always is living the spiritual life. And that most important day, the day of their death, they'll be able to die with a peaceful mind, without fear. It's said that those who have an understanding of this meditation and they practice the spiritual path through their life, whether it be, you know, Jewish or Christian or Hindu or Muslim or whatever, Buddhist, they can die not only without fear, they can die with happiness, looking forward, knowing that something that's coming in the future will be good. So that meditation, the third meditation, third main outline, so again, death is definite, the time of death is indefinite, uncertain. The third is, I touched on before, the only thing that helps at the moment of death is the Dharma. That means that those things that you've practiced spiritually that left imprint in your mind, good habits that you can take with you, or your Dharma realizations that you can call up at that mind, at that time. Oh, it was inevitable. I was going to die. No big deal. You know, from the very moment I was born, I was on the way to death. I heard one of my most what I consider to be one of the greatest politicians, but American politicians think sometimes they say he's the worst president, Jimmy Carter. Just the other day, he said in church, he said, "Do you know what did he say?" This gentleman, you heard.
I am very much at peace.
I've come to grip. What did he say?
He said he'd come to terms with death, and he's at peace, and he's ready to die.
Yeah.
But he's only 95, so...
Yeah. He's got a long time left, right.
He hasn't announced yet, but he may run.
he may be a write-in candidate, yeah. That's right. Yeah, yeah. What's your name? What's your name, sir?
Michael.
Michael, thank you. Thank you, Michael. I missed your name, this gentleman who told the dream, yeah.
Justin.
So... So we could come to terms with our death, our inevitable death, by understanding it now. If we wait until we're in the hospice, or that our parents or friends are in the hospice, to introduce spiritual qualities, that's a bit late. That's why people freak out. Older people, the counselors that try to help them to cope with the impending death. Sometimes we try to avoid that by getting plastic surgery. And I see this all every year about this time. There's these Esther Lauder, some kind of new cream that gets rid of the wrinkles. So almost forgetting about the fact. Obliterating from your mind the fact you're going to die, always pretending, even in your own mind, thinking you're young. You know, it's okay to get old. You know, this gentleman in the back had a question, I think. Dr. Brown. Yeah. You were his surrogate. Okay.
So I've looked at this question a lot, and this is an assertion. I don't know. You would agree with this or not, but I don't think that I'm speaking for myself.
Have a good day.
And I've seen a lot of people dying and going through the process and right up to the last. I don't think anybody really thinks they're going to die. You said something earlier how ignorance grasp onto this sense of a permanent self.
Right.
And it's almost like it seems to me like we can never have a true realization of death and impermanence, subtle and gross, until we've gotten a handle on the wisdom, the truth of emptiness.
Right. But also...
Is that a fair statement? Nibble away at it.
I think
you're
right.
But it's a big step to actually believe it in our heart of hearts.
Yeah, I think that's what, you know, a real sincere practitioner of any religion or any spiritual path would be one who would be constantly practicing, you know. Even in their relaxation time, they would be practicing the spiritual path in some way, mentally meditating, thinking, saying prayers or whatever, meditating. And you don't find that very often. I mean, you do see in some people who've developed their mind. So even that realization of the inevitability of death is, we might think of it as the beginning of the path, like in the Lam Rim, but it is, you're right, it is a quite, Lama said if someone had realized impermanence, like subtle impermanence, to us they would be like, they look like the Buddha to us. They would be always not involved in trivial, you know, arguments and getting angry about little things, because they would keep in mind, I'm going to die. It's not going to help, I can't take that with me. you know, always wanting to win the argument. Do you know people like that?
Yeah.
So I think you're right. I think you're right. Yes, yes, this lady. What's your name?
Joan.
Also green shirt and dark pants?
No, not green, black.
Okay, almost same, okay.
Yeah. I'm a female, that's
yeah,
for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah.
So the last point is, at the time of death, the only thing that helps is the Dharma.
Right.
And how does that transcend to people of other spiritual practices?
Right. So from a Buddhist perspective, it's not as though other, like where I live in North Carolina here, north of Asheville in the mountains, there are a lot of evangelical Christians there. I go for fitness training a couple times a week because I've had a bad year this year. I had lymphocytic colitis, Lyme disease, and then I passed a kidney stone. I won the karmic trifecta this year. So I try to get it back. And so he's an evangelical Christian who is so kind. He and his wife and kids visited me in the hospital when I was getting intravenous antibiotic in Asheville. They drove down to see me. But he was telling me, he said, actually, George, you're not going to heaven. You know, Catholics are not going to heaven. Only evangelicals are going to heaven. I mean, Catholics used to be, I remember when I was a kid, one of my friends who was Catholic said, we feel sorry for you. You're not going to heaven. You're not Catholic. And then different people, you know, Jewish, the Jews don't believe in that exactly, heaven and hell, but, you know, being favored or not. Buddhism doesn't believe that. Buddhism believes that one creates the cause for one's future, oneself, through one's actions. So on the basis of the belief in a creator God, you can become loving, compassionate, generous and work for others, creating cause of incredibly powerful instincts in your mind to, when you're born, to be born as a human again, and again to encounter spiritual teachings. If one's very doctrinaire about only this is the right one, in a future life when you may be born as a human, if that particular flavor is not around, you know, you may be bereft of any spiritual path because you're not interested in anything else. But if your appreciation is for the qualities of these religions rather than the doctrine, you know, compassion, love, wisdom, patience, forgiveness, good heart, then wherever you're born, you'll find teachers that can enhance that to you. So we believe, as many times I think, there are, you know, incredible examples. You read all the time, even people who don't follow, who say they're atheist, but have good heart. But somehow on the basis of their belief system, they can rationalize it and enhance their good heart. So it's not what club you belong to, you know, only Buddhists will be born as humans or something like that. Does that make sense? Mm. Did you have another, did the fellow next to you have a question? Okay. Oh, you were just acting as her advocate also. Okay. So let me just, let's see. So this unit is called Death and Rebirth. So I haven't addressed rebirth yet. What I tried to do, first of all, was to make a connection with the introduction of death. It's not something that's meant to be macabre or to scare people, but it's meant to be sobering. If you realize that you're going to die and you've got this incredible opportunity, you will make use of it for the best, you know, in the spiritual sense. When I was a kid, I don't know, maybe some of you who are older like I am, remember there was a show on TV. My mom used to watch it. Queen for a Day. I'm not sure if that was the program. The premise was there was some quiz, and if you won the quiz, they'd open the curtains, and there was this aisles of different stuff that you could, you got a certain number of minutes to go with a cart. That was a different, that wasn't Queen for Day. So I can't remember. Does anyone remember what it was called? Do you know? So you would be, so the person who'd won the contest would get, you know, like 5 minutes to go through the aisles. They could get groceries, or at other place there were appliances. There was a place in the back where there was a placard that represented a car. You, all you do is take it out, put it in your basket. And some people, very simple people, once the clock is going, they're just putting the groceries in there. People, the crowd is saying, stupid, you know, there's the car over there, there's the vacation in the Bahamas. And so I sometimes think the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, they're looking at us, you know, like we're, that's what we're doing. Now, the clock is going, and we're just accumulating icky, picky, teeny, weeny, trivial things that we can't take with us. We're leaving the great, you know, compassion and the things that we could, that would benefit us in the long run, much more substantial. Okay, so that was a little bit about, in there, I try to connect death and impermanence, that death is the example of subtle, death is the example of gross impermanence, and it's the most intimate to us, and so it's the best way of entry into subtle impermanence. If you want to understand subtle impermanence, and you don't understand death yet, you're lost. So you have to go from the gross, understand the gross, then understand the subtle. So what happens at the time of death? And I asked at the beginning, what was the definition? Some people proposed some ideas. I mentioned death is when the mind severs its relationship with this body. The subtlemost mind that doesn't think, you know, I'm that personality. It's something that carries the imprints, the habit energy, the karmic seeds. That consciousness, due to the karma on it, the karmic seeds on it, will find another rebirth. It will be reborn. All of us will be reborn. Some of us might be born as humans. It might be that every guy in this room will be born as a woman. Every woman will be born as a man. So that's always good to keep in mind that when people are, you know, identifying with their gender. Even in this lifetime, you know, the people that are transgender, that hormone replacement, they were a man, they become a woman, they were a woman, they became a man. Even in this lifetime, so it's not surprising in future lifetimes, we could be born in the future as in the animal realm, spirit realm, hell realm, or even a more, what is called the Deva realm. Have you talked about that, God realm, a little bit? From a Buddhist perspective, it's not the best place to be born. It's very comfortable. But like even in this lifetime, one might recognize that from a spiritual point of view, to be born as an incredibly wealthy person, all of your needs are fulfilled, you know, very handsome, very popular. Maybe your mind becomes proud, miserly, and so forth. It isn't, having those particular conditions are not necessarily conducive to the practice of the spiritual path. Of course, extreme poverty is also not conducive to the spiritual path, generally. I told some stories yesterday, maybe some who were here at the Jataka Tales remember that this one disciple of the Buddha, who, if you look at that picture of the Buddha, is the one on the lower left-hand corner, Shariputra. Shariputra, in a previous life, had prayed, made strong prayers, always been born in a family that was not too rich, not too poor. Kind of like the Goldilocks family, right? Just to, so that he, that one would be able to practice in an authentic way. So we, after death, when we understand that death is definite, and we ask, then what? We just disappear? No. From a Buddhist perspective, we don't disappear. Our mind stream will continue, and we will definitely experience another rebirth within what the Buddha calls cyclic existence, or samsara. Have you heard that word, samsara? Oh, it's interesting. samsara. So, you know what that means? The continued taking of rebirth again and again due to karma and our delusions that create the karma. At the monastery that I first encountered Buddhism, when I became a monk, we had some little rooms for the Western monks and nuns, like cells. There was like, I don't know, about that size. Like you can imagine in us in the Christian and other traditions. And outside there was a toilet for the men and the women. The men's side was called Sam, and the women's side was called Sarah. To remind, samsara, okay, to remind us of the cyclic existence. So, the connection here, why does it say death and rebirth? Because when we die, we don't disappear. And where we will be reborn, how we will be reborn, depends upon what we did with this life. So understanding this, you know, looking again and again, I'm going to die every instant. I'm getting closer to death, like the person on the way to the gallows. The actions that I create that only are for the happiness of this lifetime will not have any repercussions in the future, beneficial repercussions, like the ripples of a lake that disappear. What we need to be able to do is to leave some imprint in our mind of great, you know, the great spiritual minds of Christ and Mahatma Gandhi and, you know, the Dalai Lamas and the Buddha, of course. So that's kind of the connection here. So I'll have a chance of, I believe, unless the person who's in charge of the course sees this video and says, oh, you're not teaching next week, I'll talk to you next week. But just before we finish, we still have a couple minutes. We have about 5 minutes. Anyone else have a final thought or question they wanted to raise or comments they wanted to? Yes, Zach. Zach must be a computer programmer.
No.
No? A teacher.
So my question is on this, the kind of the action of rebirth. Is this something that, you know, this is something that I, of course, and I think it's kind of common to, like, have a hard time grasping the, how it occurs and, like, the process that seems, it seems oversimplified, the idea that, like, dying and then there's this thing that is the mind and it jumps to a new body. And is it the way that I've thought about it that could be a possible way of from what I've been reading is that maybe it's is it more of a once death occurs, the mind is still there's still a consciousness stream and it generates a new body, or is there already a body that is where there is a form? And there's like a movement through space to that body.
Yeah, good question. So from a Buddhist perspective, as we're approaching death, in a similar fashion as when we fall asleep, the gross sense consciousnesses, like we have an eye consciousness, you say, we call it gross consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, tactile consciousness, the five senses. There was a movie some years ago called The Sixth Sense. Remember that? Anyway, I don't talk about the plot of that, but just as though like, wow, the sixth sense. The mental consciousness is the sixth sense. There's no worry about that. So when you fall asleep at night, the gross consciousnesses absorb, we say, the energy that provides their impetus to be at the organs, whether you can see or hear or smell, taste, that absorbs back to a central place in our body where the mental consciousness has its main activity. Main place for the mental consciousness is not the brain, surprisingly. We would think that from a Western perspective. But the mind is something which is of a different continuum than matter. It has its own continuum flow. So you may have, as your senses are absorbing, someone opens your eye, you probably did with your brother or sister and when you were a kid, you know, they don't see unless you shake them and they wake up. They don't hear, taste, smell, because the gross senses are absorbed. The mental consciousness continues in sometimes quiet, like deep, deep sleep, no dream, sometimes vibrating up a little bit into dream state, subtle mind. At the time of death, even that mind totally absorbs into the subtlemost mind, which when it leaves this body, severs the karmic connection. It doesn't mean like it's shot out somewhere, but it is no longer karmically connected with this body. We enter into what's called the intermediate state, the bardo. And depending on our karma, we may be impelled to a certain location. Let's say if we were to be born as a human again, we have the karma to be born as a human, where a mother and father are engaged in intercourse, sexual intercourse, when the egg, when the sperm and the egg join, the mind in the intermediate state can enter into that, and that's said to be the vivifying factor that causes, what's the right term, mitosis, you know, the splitting and so forth. Sometimes you can put an egg and sperm together and nothing happens. From a Buddhist perspective, what's needed is the mind entering into it. So it's not that the mind, when we leave here, we enter into some frozen body in some realm that then pops up. We enter just as we know from life, we enter into a fertilized egg. There are other ways of rebirth also, but that's, say, as a human. So I just use that as an example. There are other kinds of ways that we can be reborn. There was a conference, a mind-life conference with the Dalai Lama some years ago, and some people said, oh, we're on the verge of having computers that can think. Do you think they could be, you know, that, how did the person say, that we could, you know, they could be human, that they could, that, what are they always talking about? Machines could be
sentient,
yeah, thinking and so forth. And the Dalai Lama was chuckling, and he said, it's possible. You know, you don't have to enter into only, a mind doesn't have to enter into only a fertilized egg. Depends on your karma, what fortune you have. You might enter into like a wall, your mind. Like in the time of the Buddha, there are stories that the naughty monks outside would, like men, would make pee-pee outside, right? Urinate on the wall. They created the karma when they died to be born in the wall. Their mind would be, and be, peed on by others long periods of time. That would end it sometimes. It was almost like a hell existence, you know. So he used that as an example. It's possible that in the future you could be born within a circuit board in a silicon chip. And he pointed to the person and said, and you, by thinking it that way and appreciating it, are creating the karma to do that. You may be so there might be some computer that becomes sentient, but not because of connecting the wires together, but because someone had that weird karma to be reborn in that, like hell or whatever. Yes, ma'am.
So, is there choice for rebirth?
Eventually, when one has great control, there is choice. But at our level, and even as Don implied, you know, most people, there's not any choice. We are blown by the winds of karma, you could say. You know, pardon? Well, throwing karma is just the karma. You could kind of understand it that way. The word throwing karma sounds like that. Throwing karma just means the karma that determines where you will take rebirth, not which particular parents you will take birth with and so forth. Some beings, because of their great love and compassion and spiritual qualities, make very strong prayers, aspirations. So it's not praying the Buddha to be born somewhere. The Buddha, it's up to our own karma. But like really wishing strongly to be born as a man or a woman, to benefit people of a particular country, and that can impel the rebirth in such a way. But those with great control who have meditated this lifetime, and very subtle meditations control the mind, at the time of death, they can experience that clear light mind and control that. They can actually take rebirth exactly where they want. But generally, it's with let's say, if they're born as a human, born to parents that they have some karmic relationship with. When my teacher passed away, Lama Yeshe, before he passed away, he told this couple in Spain, he told the wife that she was a perfect example of a mother and made other allusions about, you know, being with them. In the future, he was born, when he passed away, he was born as their child. Lama Usel, he's called. Maybe you read that book, Little Lama, was it? I think it was on the syllabus that they told me it was Boy Lama. Did you read that? Was that on this list? Maybe it's something you read later. So I don't want to go over. It's my Apple Watch, which is pretty accurate, says it's 8:34 or 8:33, so I don't want to go over. Thank you very much for your attention. Unless I'm given the black slip, I'll be with you next week. I'm just visiting until then, and then I'll be going back to my cabin. And so I'll see you then. And if you know of others who missed, I think this is, will it be up on the website? Yeah. If you like to hear some other teachings, I'll give a talk on Wednesday on the Four Noble Truths. And the following Wednesday also, the connection between the Four Noble Truths and what are called the 12 Links of Dependent Origination. You're welcome to come. So let's just do a final thought, a dedication. Whatever virtuous energy I've created tonight, may it not be just like ripples on a lake. May it, in whatever way it ripens, whatever way I reap the benefits of this in future lives or in this lifetime, may the way that it ripened always be in a way that accelerates my spiritual development, that acts to support my spiritual development, always generating in me the impulse for love and compassion, understanding, wisdom, understanding impermanence and the ultimate nature of phenomena, so that I can eventually reach a state where I don't harm people at all. I don't harm living beings at all. And from that state, I can actually benefit them in a real, meaningful way. In whatever way these karmic seeds we've left tonight ripen, may they act to lead me to full enlightenment for the benefit of all living beings. Thank you very much. Drive safely. I don't think there's any big, there's no big baseball, football game tonight, so you should drive. Take care.